President Trump is in Paris ahead of Bastille Day celebrations tomorrow. The President and First Lady Melania met with President Macron and First Lady Brigitte outside Napoleon's tomb. The two men had a long, bracing handshake, although not the wince-inducing one they had at the NATO summit in May that was more like arm wrestling. Later this month, the two will hold a press conference, rather later this hour, and President Trump could be questioned for the first time by the press about his son's meeting with what was purported in an email to be a Russian government lawyer, part of a Russian plan to undermine Hillary Clinton. And despite that email, before he left for France, the president told Pat Robertson on the Christian Broadcast Network that Vladimir Putin would have rather seen Clinton win the election.
If Hillary had won, our military would be decimated. Mm-hmm. Our energy would be much more expensive. That's what Putin doesn't like about me.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us from Paris. And Eleanor, we'll get to the Russian story, but what are you seeing in the body language of the two men so far?
The body language is very friendly. You know, the commentators keep saying, yes, these are two men who differ on pretty much every issue, but there seems to be a personal affinity between them. They're starting to get to know each other now. They've met several times. And, you know, when President Trump stepped out of his limousine that the French press is loving, talking about Le Beast.
Wait, what is The Beast?
Oh, well, The Beast is his limousine, and the French press is just going, media's going wild over it. It's called The Beast, apparently, and I'm hearing Le Beast all the time, you know. They're really excited over that. And he steps out, and Macron greets him very warmly, and the First Lady's kissed. President Trump kissed Brigitte Macron, the French First Lady. And, you know, and they came into the courtyard of Les Invalides. There was an honor guard, military honors. Trump is very flattered, it seems, with all of this. I mean, Macron is really giving him all the top honors, especially military things. And both men touched each other. Trump touched Macron's shoulder, and Macron put his hand on President Trump's back. So they really do seem to have sort of they like each other, well, it seems.
It seems. Well, they are both politicians, and this is stagecraft. Because remind us of some of the language leading up to this. President Trump pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Accord on climate change. President Macron invited Americans who weren't happy with that to move to France.
People here are still angry that President Trump has taken the U.S. out of the Paris climate deal. Emmanuel Macron is not going to change his mind. He knows that. So he's focusing on the issues that they can see eye to eye on, and that is, you know, military cooperation, security cooperation, fighting terrorism. President Macron gave an interview in the newspaper this morning. He said the U.S. is an indispensable ally. And to all those who criticized him for inviting President Trump, he said, you know, we've got 200 years of alliance and history between us. It's not because of a few disagreements that we're going to turn our back on one of our best allies. And also, President Macron wants to keep America engaged within the circle of nations. And he, you know, he seems to have a good relationship with President Trump, and he seems to want to play the role of the intermediary to keep, you know, America, keep President Trump in, because it seems that Donald Trump and German Chancellor Angela Merkel do not really have a warm relationship. So maybe Macron can be that person to make the link.
Well, of course, tomorrow is Bastille Day, a reminder of the relations between the countries, the French grateful to the U.S. For their part in World War I. But I'm imagining tomorrow might be a pretty somber Bastille Day, because it is also the one-year anniversary of that terrorist attack in Nice, 84 people killed, dozen injured.
Yeah, that's sad. And the French president will fly down to Nice as soon as the Bastille Day parade is over. Everyone will be talking about that. Today, actually, the magazine Paris Match had photos published from the video cameras from that night, and the Paris prosecutor said ordered the magazine to be taken off newsstands because the pictures were seen as offensive to the families of the victims. So people are still hurting over that attack, yes.
Yeah. We mentioned the controversy here over Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with what he thought were Russian government lawyers, part of a Russian government plan to support his father in the campaign. We'll see if that is a question that's raised at the brief press conference today. But what is the French press saying about this?
They're just, you know, amazed by it, watching it unfold, a bit titillated by the whole thing. It just seems to deepen and affect more people every week. You know, Emmanuel Macron's campaign was allegedly hacked by Russian hackers as well. So they're very familiar with the Russians supposedly interfering or allegedly interfering in elections. Because in front of President Putin, actually, President Macron called out not hackers, not Russian hackers, but the Russian media. And he called them in front of President Putin, Russia Today and Sputnik. He said, the journalists who followed me from those channels were not journalists. They were propagandists and they were spreading lies. He said that in front of President Putin when Putin visited. So he's not afraid to say what he thinks is going on.
NPR's Eleanor Beardsley in Paris. Eleanor, thank you.
You're welcome, Robin.
Google is being accused of buying favorable research from academics to sway public opinion and bolster its case against government regulators. The tech giant has funded hundreds of academic papers on topics such as copyright and data collection over the past decade, paying anywhere from $5,000 to $400,000 to researchers whose work supports Google business practices. The company says the funding comes with no strings attached and that they encourage disclosure. But in many cases, researchers did not disclose that Google was funding their work, according to a new report by the advocacy group Campaign for Accountability and separate reporting from The Wall Street Journal. Jack Nickus co-wrote the story for The Wall Street Journal, and he joins us now. And Jack, according to your reporting, funding is actually just the beginning. Google even went so far as to come up with working titles for some of these papers, abstracts, and even budgets for studies they wanted written?
Right. So we did speak to a former Google employee and a former Google lobbyist who said that in some years, and especially during the most aggressive period of this program several years ago, the company was preparing essentially what was a wish list of papers each year. And what they would do is then go out and look for authors who already agreed with Google's position, and they would try to fund those authors to try to get them to write more, because that would increase the amount of literature out there that agreed with Google's positions and backed its business practices. Mm.
There are lots of industries and sectors where this is not an uncommon practice. So is it a big deal at all that Google is doing this, or is this much ado about nothing? Is there something different about what Google does that that is raising eyebrows?
So I don't think there's anything that is exceptionally different of what Google is doing here. But what's new is that the tech industry is emerging as the big power in American business and in really global business. And with that, they are flexing their muscles in Washington and elsewhere with their lobbying efforts. And this is one big piece of that. And beyond that, what we saw in past cases was, companies, industries like the food industry or the drug companies that were funding medical or scientific research. And that, in turn, spurred professional standards in medical journals about disclosure. What we're now seeing is some of these tech companies are funding law professors, and legal journals don't have as many disclosure rules or formal standards for corporate funding. And so that may spur some changes in the law professor community about how money is accepted and how it's disclosed.
Well, Jack, in this story, as in just about every story, we've got to follow the money here. And I see that Google has called the Campaign for Accountability, this group that issued a report about Google's funding of academic papers, they've called that campaign's report highly misleading, and in fact have pointed out that the group is receiving funding from Oracle, one of Google's competitors. So help us understand this part of the story.
Certainly. We did receive some initial data from the Campaign for Accountability. We did our own analysis to get our own count based on their data. So Google has its own issues with the Campaign for Accountability, but we made sure that our story rested on our own reporting.
I see. So finally, Jack, let me ask you about ultimately efficacy here in terms of Google's thoughts on how effective their funding is. Because, for example, last month, European regulators issued, a $2.7 billion fine against Google for unfairly favoring its services over rivals in its search results. And also the FTC here in the United States has also investigated Google for antitrust violations. So do we have any evidence that the academic research that Google has been funding, have they used it to push back against these regulations? Has that been effective?
Well, we certainly have evidence that they have used this research to push against regulations. We did view a letter that Google attorneys sent to the Federal Trade Commission during its antitrust investigation into Google in 2012 that cited research funded by Google. But certainly, this is not something that you're going to see a direct relationship between a funded paper and Google getting off clean from regulators. It's more, it seems to be one part of a broader lobbying effort to try to promote research and promote ideas that back Google's business practices. And certainly, no, Google has not been able to escape regulators' ire altogether. You note a very large fine and potentially some problematic changes to Google's business in Europe. But we must also say that the FTC spent nearly 2 years investigating Google into its businesses for an antitrust, potential antitrust violations, and Google did get off with virtually few changes. And that was something that many Google opponents were upset about.
Jack Nickus is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. We'll have a link to his story at hereandnow.org. Jack, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Jessamyn Stanley is a yogi with more than 300,000 devoted fans who follow her every move on Instagram. Headstands, backbends, warrior poses. Beautiful, but not the body we're accustomed to seeing in yoga magazines. Slim men and women, usually white. Jessamyn is African-American, and as she says in her new book, I am fat, and what she calls a body-positive advocate. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of interviewing Jessamyn in front of a couple hundred adoring followers at the Boston Public Library. She talked about internet trolls who body-shame her or ask, aren't you worried about your health? Her response, what about your health? Why are you asking such an intimate question? I can Google. I know about heart disease, diabetes. She wants to encourage others to stop apologizing for who they are and start practicing. Jessamyn Stanley's new book is Everybody Yoga, Let Go of Fear, Get on the Mat, Love Your Body. She joins us from WUNC in Durham, North Carolina. Jessamyn, nice to speak with you again.
Hey, Robin. I'm happy to be here.
Start with, what do people say to you about being not the image that they have of a yogi?
You know, I think that the idea that we have of a yoga practitioner is very much limited by what the media thinks is appropriate to show. And the only people that they really focus any energy on, not just in the yoga spectrum, are white bodies. They are frequently small, slender bodies. They are traditionally educated. They have a certain amount of money. And because that is the only body that many people have any association of when it comes to yoga, they see me and they're like, whoa, you're so different. Mm. This is crazy. How are you doing this? And I'm just like, I'm not really representative of a minority. I'm really representative of the majority. Because if you go to yoga studios, they are much more diverse than what our world shows. And I think that instead of really expanding an image, I'm really just shedding light on bodies who have always been present in the yoga space.
Well, and for those who say, I'm not as comfortable as you are quite yet with my body, I'm not sure I want to go to that yoga space. You say do it at home.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that there's a big obsession on being in a traditional yoga studio and having a teacher watch you and having other people around you. But truly, the meat and potatoes of any long-lasting yoga practice will be in a home practice. You don't always have the money. You don't always have the time. You can still have the same kind of, and even a deeper experience in a home practice. Yeah.
Well, you recommend online classes like yogaglow.com. You know, there's tons of information in your book. And you say get away from looking for the perfect image in a mirror in a class, but you do tell people photograph themselves like you do.
Yeah, I think that there's a very important look within the self that can happen whenever you look at photographs of yourself. And in that process, I started to see how much I am capable of doing that I had not been taught to appreciate. I'd really been taught that as a fat-bodied person, I should be ashamed of my body, that I should, you know, have excuses for it. And through this practice of photographing myself and looking at the photos, and again, this is a separate issue from me posting the photos somewhere,
right,
but just taking the photos can be a really, really powerful therapy.
Well, because you're seeing yourself, and look at you. I mean, looking at the cover, you're doing this thingy where you bend backwards and you reach a foot and you get your foot pulled up there. I mean, yes, this is a larger body, but it's stunning. I mean, is that part of it, being able to really see yourself?
I think that it's seeing yourself as you actually are. So I spent a lot of time in my life apologizing for certain parts of my body. Let's use my stomach as an example. It's like, oh my gosh, I should be doing this thing, that thing, and I should be covering it. I should be, you know, there's all this negative energy put toward that part of my body. In the case of the cover image, it's not like, wow, look at that camel pose with a mermaid bind. I'm so proud of, look at how strong I am. It's like, wow, I am a real person that is doing that, and my stomach is there. It's a part of that. That if I feel confident in myself, then I have to own my stomach as a part of that. And I think that that's kind of the therapeutic part, that it's like you have this safe space to accept the parts of yourself that you've been taught to dislike.
Well, and I just want to touch on the health thing. We heard you respond to it, you know, people asking you about your body. Is part of your message, some bodies can't be made skinny. They're not built that way.
You know, I don't really think about what can and can't be. I really just sort of like to focus on the present moment as opposed to thinking like, yeah, you know, I guess I'm just never going to be smaller bodied, or I'm always going to be larger bodied. And it doesn't really matter what you could or couldn't be. The point is what you are right now. Hmm. And that right now, I want to take care of this body as best I can. I don't want to obsess over it, thinking about what it could or couldn't be, or what it was or what it should be. It's just about what it is.
Right. Or wait till it gets to be something else.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Because then you get into a position where you're just waiting the rest of your life for something to be different. And, you know, the day that you're waiting for is now.
That includes clothing. You write, you followed the fat girl exercise protocol, baggy t-shirt, and so much shame. You know, you felt you weren't allowed to wear the nice clothes, but there you are. You know, the skimpiest stuff. You're rocking it.
Yeah, I definitely did not always feel that way. I was always very self-conscious about myself and felt like, you know, there were certain clothes that I was not supposed to wear or that I didn't deserve to wear. And truly, the fashion industry upholds that ideal to a T. That's why there are so many brands that don't even have extended sizing. And this is really what it comes down to. They do not believe that larger bodied people deserve to have the same clothing options as smaller bodied people. And as I was practicing, I realized that it's not helpful to wear bag and sag and pants. And then if you are, you know, constantly having a shirt that pulls up around your eyes, you can't find your drishti, your gaze. So to me, it's really an exploration into what makes me feel like I can be myself. And that has, in the end, been very few clothes.
Yeah. I mean, I love the questions that you get. You know, what if I fart during a class? Well, so what? What if I fall, get up again? And also, take care of your needs. So you got this tip, I guess, from another yoga teacher. But if you are a full-chested woman, use a yoga strap. If you have illustrations in the book, kind of like tamp yourself down or something.
Yeah, totally. I mean, every yoga teacher has their tricks that they've learned from maneuvering within their own body. And one thing that's really common and that I talk about in the book is if you have very large breasts, it's difficult to not choke yourself, honestly, in many poses. And the teacher that you were referencing, Amber Carnes, she is from Virginia. She's an amazing, amazing body positive yoga teacher. And she definitely kind of coined this trick of wrapping a yoga strap around your chest to protect your neck from your breast. But it's the kind of thing that, you know, you learn over time. And in Everybody Yoga, I really want to encourage people to step out into themselves and take whatever props and whatever movements need to happen in order to really enjoy the pose for them.
Yeah. I want to just touch a bit on you as a young girl, because this is part memoir. And you describe yourself as the epitome of a big, black, beautiful African queen trapped in a sea of dainty-lipped, pale-skinned sea nymphs in the white southern suburban community you grew up in. You idolized the cheerleaders. You wanted to be a beauty contestant. You read Teen Magazine. You read books like The Babysitter Club, loved Gwen Stefani's Just a Girl video. And, you know, people called you an Oreo, you know, trying to find your way. Are you comfortable, completely comfortable in your skin?
I don't know if anyone is completely comfortable in their skin. I am always questioning whenever people tell me, like, oh, I'm just so comfortable with everything. Because I'm like, really? How is that happening? I'm still very much trying to understand myself in a kind of recovery from life, from trying to understand myself in the gaze of other people, and now trying to understand my own gaze. I can only imagine that this is a journey that I'll be on for the rest of my life. And I would never say that I've reached any kind of stopping point or that I've figured everything out. I don't know anything. I know what I know today, and that is yoga. Understanding that you're always trying to find the balance, and ultimately that is the balance.
Hmm. By the way, where was your high school?
I went to Salem Academy in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And if anyone who's listening to this went to Salem Academy, go Sabres, class of 2005. I felt like I had to say that.
Well, and I'm just thinking the cheerleading squad is probably saying, geez, why didn't we put her on?
What the? No, we didn't have a cheerleading squad, but my middle school did have a cheerleading squad. And I always thought that, you know, I was the long lost cheerleader that they always wanted. And they wholeheartedly disagreed. And I honestly think that, you know, if I could go back and if I could be a fly on the wall, I would probably wholeheartedly disagree too. So everything worked out the way it should have worked out.
It's
We're
okay.
all good.
Jasmine Stanley, her book again, Everybody Yoga, Let Go of Fear, Get on the Mat, Love Your Body. Jasmine, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you so much for having me.
And the book, I should say, is now I can't pry it out of the hands of Meghna Chakrabarty.
I've got it here.
Isn't it great? The pictures
are fabulous. And which I love what she says, that yoga is really a journey of self-discovery. And it doesn't matter what kind of body that self inhabits.
Well, I love when she says, don't wait. What are you waiting for? There's that great child book, Waiting for Your Hair to Grow, Waiting for It to Snow.
Right now, I'm just waiting to get off the air so we can do this, Robin.
It's here now. Today, Senate Republicans released a new version of their health care bill to repeal and replace much of the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. NPR's congressional reporter Scott Detrow joins us. And Scott, what do you see? What are the biggest changes in this new version?
Let's divide it into two camps here, the changes that seem to be aimed at winning support from moderate Republicans and the changes that seem to be aimed at earning support from more conservative Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to hear moderates or conservatives first?
Let's go with the fiscal conservatives like Rand Paul. He didn't think the first bill went far enough in repealing Obamacare. So
that's right. So there is language in this bill based on an idea first pushed by Texas Senator Ted Cruz that would allow insurance companies to offer scaled back plans. They're referring to them as catastrophic plans here, that as long as they have at least one plan on the markets that checks all the boxes of requirements that Obamacare currently has for insurance plans.
Yeah.
They say that this would allow customers to have cheaper plans. But the concern from a lot of analysts is that that would really mess with the markets, because you would have all the younger, healthier people going to these cheaper plans, leaving small pools of people who are high cost.
Okay. Well, then Susan Collins, one of the moderates, is one of those who worried that the previous bill went too far, kicked too many people off Medicaid, for instance. What's there for those concerns?
Well, one thing that doesn't address concerns for people like Collins is that this latest version, by and large, keeps all the changes to Medicaid that you saw in previous versions in place. And she and other moderates had a lot of concerns. This still does a lot for them. It keeps a lot of the tax requirements in place. It does not scale back taxes, which had been a big Democratic attack point on these plans. It also delivers $45 billion more for opioid treatment and $70 billion in additional money for states to deal with cost assistance, cost stabilization. States could use this in different ways to help bring down prices of insurance.
A lot of the senators who were balking were worried about the cuts to the opioid care. Well,
yeah.
The Republicans need 50 of 52 GOP senators to pass this bill. Did leader Mitch McConnell put in enough bait? Will he lure them?
We will see. I think a few key things to keep an eye on. One, over the course of the day, as lawmakers analyze this, I'm sure we will be hearing opinions and whether this changed anyone's mind. A couple landmarks coming up Monday or Tuesday next week. The Congressional Budget Office will release its latest analysis of this bill. There will be key numbers there. How many people would lose insurance because of this? How much it would cost? Things like that. That'll help make up a lot of lawmakers' minds. And then we'll see a test vote at some point next week, a vote to proceed on debate. If Mitch McConnell can't get 50 votes or more there, this bill is in big trouble, and that might actually be the end.
Well, and President Trump said again last night he would be very angry if that happened. Is that going to be enough of a prod for these lawmakers who also are looking behind them at their constituents that they just left after break and got an earful about people don't want to lose their health coverage?
I think actually the anger that's a bigger concern is voter anger, but a lot of Republican lawmakers in the House and Senate are concerned about the anger of hardcore supporters, base supporters, who have been voting for them election after election when Republicans have promised to repeal Obamacare, and they feel like there might be more political danger in not repealing Obamacare than in keeping the current system in place after years of promises on their end.
NPR congressional reporter Scott Detrow, as you said, Scott, will be following this all day on NPR, including on All Things Considered, see what people think at the end of the day. Scott, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Senate Republicans have made some significant changes in their health care bill, but one thing remains the same. This bill, like earlier versions, would make historic changes to the way the federal government pays for the Medicaid program. And that is raising a red flag for two former directors of Medicaid. Andy Slavitt ran Medicare and Medicaid in the Obama administration, and Gail Wilensky did the same under George H.W. Bush. And in an article in the JAMA Forum, the two of them say they'd like to see changes in the Medicaid program, but not the ones outlined in the current health care bills. They are urging Congress to separate the two efforts and tackle Medicaid changes in a slower, more bipartisan way. Gail Wilensky joins us now via Skype. She's currently an economist and senior fellow at Project Hope, an international health foundation. Welcome to Here and Now.
Pleasure to be with you.
Well, first of all, let me ask you, Republican leaders such as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell have said very clearly that they think radical changes are needed to Medicaid in order to preserve and strengthen the program in the long run. Let me just ask you, I mean, do you agree with that? Are radical changes needed?
Substantive changes in how the program is structured and financed could help improve the program. Of course, a word like radical is something that will mean different things to different people. So we'd probably be on better grounds to talk about where Medicaid could be significantly improved or has some high-risk areas, and in ways in which Medicaid has been very effective in the past. It actually is, in many ways, the unsung hero of expanding coverage under the Affordable Care Act. It's carried most of the burden, and it has seemed to have done so thus far without a lot of the trauma and drama that we have seen in the exchanges. Hmm. That doesn't mean it isn't ripe for some modifications, including the obvious one is that the federal government can't, won't, shouldn't be footing 100% of the expansion population costs indefinitely. It's already on a walk down to a 90% match rate.
Well, as you mentioned, Medicaid, in your words, is the unsung hero of healthcare recently. More than 70 million people receiving Medicaid benefits. For example, 70% of resources go to folks with disabilities or living in nursing homes, vast amounts of low-income children and families as well. But you and Andy Slavitt are calling for efforts to reform Medicaid and those efforts to be separated from the current attempts to address the Affordable Care Act. So why would you like to separate the two?
We've looked at the issues. We've both been responsible for running Medicare and Medicaid. And believe that it's better to separate them because the individual insurance market needs to be stabilized, it needs to be addressed, and it needs to happen in the near term because we are seeing too much churn in the exchange. Too many of the insurance companies had already been pulling out even before some of the additional uncertainties that have been addressed. That needs to be done now. And we think it is the easier problem to take on initially. For Medicaid, there are clear differences of opinion, even among those who think change may be appropriate. It needs to happen in a bipartisan way. I think it needs a little longer time frame. We've arbitrarily said a 12-month period, but that absolutely has to happen in a bipartisan way. It's a major part of the way we provide support to aged and disabled people who are low income and also to poor low income families, moms and kids. And we think recognizing the different populations is important.
Now, in your article, which we're going to link to at hereandnow.org, you actually suggest sort of six different areas in which Medicaid can be improved. Don't have time to go through all of them, unfortunately, but let me just ask you about a couple of them. The first one is you mentioned making it more outcomes-based. Now, what exactly would that mean within the Medicaid program?
This is a movement that's going on everywhere in healthcare. We've talked about it for commercial insurance, having it the outcomes measures what happens to people as a result of their care rather than just input focused. That is, how many hours were spent or what procedure was being done. Medicare has also moved to this in the accountable care organizations that have been promoted and in the many people who have managed care that are called Medicare Advantage plans. Medicaid has been behind those groups in terms of not focusing on what happens in terms of low birth weight babies or prenatal care received by mothers or immunization rates or maternal mortality, the kinds of outcomes of healthcare that are so important. This is something that needs to happen in any case, whether or not there is even greater flexibility provided. Medicaid actually does provide a lot of potential flexibility through waivers that can be granted to states or state plan amendments that can be given. But they're very time-consuming efforts on the part of the state, take a lot of time away from actually providing care. And it's streamlining or granting less need for that kind of a waiver process, potentially in return for this increased flexibility, but with some real accountability, as we've said, is the kind of trade-off we'd like to see in place.
You also mentioned an area of improvement in terms of getting more doctors to accept patients who are on Medicaid and also how the program could play a role in helping to control healthcare costs overall. So there are a lot of areas here in which Medicaid is obviously, as you're saying, ripe for reform. But I'm curious, given the current political climate, do you think that there is an appetite for this slower, more considered bipartisan reform process, this year-long process that you're talking about? Is that even a possibility now?
Well, it's a possibility only if the short-term effort currently underway to try to get something done in a hurry doesn't work. So if Republicans can come up with their 50 votes, then I think they are very eager to move this along and get on to other issues. If the Republicans and the leadership are not able to pass a healthcare reform bill, there may be a willingness to think about other ways, maybe not so much as a frontal focus at the moment, but to allow these other ways to proceed. Find short-term ways to try to stabilize the individual insurance market, which is probably responsible for no more than 7 or 8 million of the 20 million newly insured. Keep that at least going forward. While there were some side efforts to find these longer term solutions for Medicaid. Now, is there an interest or a taste or a drive for that? It's not been obvious at the moment. We'll have to wait and see. There are real issues, challenges in Medicaid that, as you said, is responsible for the care of 70 million people, minority of whom are aged and disabled, but they account for the very serious amount of spending that goes on, and their care is very uncoordinated and could be improved and provided more efficiently, that is, at lower cost. But it will require care to make all the pieces go in place that could produce that. Is there the will to do that? Is there the interest to do that? Hasn't been obvious in the last near-term period. But maybe if this wasn't going to work, there'll be a willingness to take that on if and as people have time in the Congress.
Well, Gail Wilensky is an economist and senior fellow at Project Hope, an international health foundation. She was the director of Medicaid and Medicare under President George H.W. Bush, speaking to us today via Skype. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I am looking forward to having good things happen in the future.
A passing that must be noted. The Chinese political prisoner and Nobel Peace Prize winner Liao Xiaobo died today. He was serving an 11-year prison sentence for inciting subversion of state power for his part in drafting a pro-democracy manifesto that called for an end to one-party rule in China. Last month, he was granted medical parole after being diagnosed with late-stage liver cancer. His supporters say it was already too late. Liao was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize while in prison in 2010. The Nobel Committee calling him the foremost symbol of this wide-ranging struggle for human rights in China, which infuriated the Chinese government. He was a visiting scholar at Columbia University in 1989 when student demonstrators occupied Tiananmen Square, and he returned to Beijing to support the protesters, then serving the first of four prison terms for his challenge to China's authoritarian rule. Liao Xiaobo was 61. Well, the fight against the Zika virus has been ramped up to try to eliminate the specific mosquitoes known to carry the disease in parts of the country where they live. But some parts of the country were already in an all-out war with the insects. Nancy Klingener of Here and Now contributor WLRN reports from the Florida Keys, where scientists are experimenting with a new method for killing mosquitoes.
Three times a week, a UPS truck drops off a cardboard box at an office building on Stock Island, just outside of Key West. Catherine Przinski slices open the cardboard.
So, in this white box is a styrofoam cooler.
Przinski is a research biologist with the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District.
And within the styrofoam cooler are 25 cardboard tubes full of mosquitoes.
Each tube holds 1,000 mosquitoes that make their presence known.
And that's them we can hear?
Yeah, that's them. Males are just as active as females. They buzz. I think there was a rumor going around that males don't buzz, but males definitely buzz.
What male mosquitoes don't do is bite. All the mosquitoes in these tubes are male, and they have a mission to mate with females in the wild. The males are Aedes aegypti. That's the kind of mosquito that carries Zika and dengue fever. They come from a Kentucky-based company called MosquitoMate, and they've been infected with a bacteria called Wolbachia. Wolbachia is found in a lot of insects, but not Aedes aegypti mosquitoes.
When these males are infected and they mate with the females, it results in sterility.
The females lay eggs, but there's no next generation.
There's no larval development, no nothing. The eggs are just empty.
Since last year's Zika outbreak, mosquitoes have been a major concern in South Florida. Miami-Dade County, next-door neighbor to the Keys, had two areas of local transmission and hundreds of cases. The Keys only saw a handful of Zika cases, and none of them were locally transmitted.
We're fortunate here that we have a world-class mosquito control district.
Bob Eady is public health director for the Keys. The island chain was already on high alert about Aedes aegypti because Key West had an outbreak of dengue fever in 2009. The first locally transmitted cases in the U.S. in decades.
It was troubling. It's a very debilitating disease while you have it.
The Keys Mosquito Control District stepped up its efforts to eradicate Aedes aegypti then. They hired more inspectors who go house to house checking for places the mosquitoes might breed. Waking up to helicopters spraying larvicide over the island is a normal part of life in Key West. The district has an annual budget of more than $11 million. Almost $150 for every resident of the island chain.
Probably without mosquito control and air conditioning, you and I wouldn't be sitting here in Key West right now.
On a breezy morning, Catherine Przinski releases the Wolbachia mosquitoes on Stock Island. She's in an area with trailer parks and big lots where lobster traps are stored in the off-season.
Okay, so I'm going to release the first tube.
She pulls a piece of cardboard from inside the tube with most of the mosquitoes on it, but a few need some encouragement to leave the tube. The mosquitoes are released three times a week in a 10-acre trial site. Mosquito traps there and in a nearby control area will show whether the Wolbachia-infected males are having an effect on the overall population. Meanwhile, the first U.S. trial of genetically modified mosquitoes, also Aedes aegypti, has been proposed for the Keys. That trial won federal approval, but has been delayed after residents of the proposed testing area voted against the trial. Megan Hall was one of the opponents.
It was like, oh gosh, you know, call off the dogs already. Back off the GMO mosquito. Okay, I know it's sexy science, but just back off that for right now.
Like many GMO opponents, Hull says using the bacteria Wolbachia is a much better option for controlling mosquitoes.
Wolbachia is a naturally occurring life form. Anything genetically modified is, in my opinion, an artificially introduced invasive species.
The Wolbachia trial has been extended beyond its original 12-week period. Scientists will then evaluate the results and decide whether to continue testing this possible tool to fight the mosquitoes that carry Zika. For Here and Now, I'm Nancy Klingener.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.